Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Femi Okeh. It's Here and Now. Democrats met on the debate stage last night in Houston. The focus was on Joe Biden, center stage, surrounded by ideological opponents Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. The candidates fought over healthcare, Biden's legacy, but they were also united, especially in their attacks against President Trump. Here is Kamala Harris addressing the president directly in her opening statement.
You've spent the last 2.5 years full-time trying to sow hate and division among us, and that is why we've gotten nothing done. You have used hate, intimidation, fear, and over 12,000 lies as a way to distract from your failed policies and your broken promises.
For more on the debate, we're joined by Democratic strategist Jamal Simmons. Jamal, let's start with the big question. I saw you were tweeting last night. No extreme compliments, but some Twitter analysis. But let's take it into the real world. Who do you think came out on top in this debate?
So I think who came out on top in this debate was probably, I don't know, the Democratic Party. Not in particular.
I don't know. Thank you for that deep analysis, Jamal.
How's that? Because I wouldn't characterize it that way. I think there were kind of nobody failed completely. Uh-huh. I don't think anybody kind of hit the ball out of the park. People had some troubling moments. I mean, I think, listen, Joe Biden had some pretty tough moments last night that he's going to spend some time having to explain. Castro, while he's being beaten up for beating up on Biden, I think Julian Castro has proven himself to be a pretty tough fighter in a way that nobody really expected him to be.
With Joe Biden, it always seems to be race that is problematic for him. Talk us through that last night, and what did you see?
Well, you know, he was asked a question about a 40-year-old statement that he made that he doesn't think he owes the black man a head start. You know, he has never really explained that statement. It's a longer statement than what I just read, but he never really explained that statement. And last night he went into some explanation about it that really rambled through a whole series of things, including trying to put social workers in African-American households and making kids listen to record players, not even CDs, but record players in order to get their words up, and ended with something about Venezuelan children. It was a really weird moment. You know, that came late in the debate. It was late at night and late in the debate. And I don't, you know, I think it's the questions Castro raised in the beginning about Vice President Biden's forgetfulness or stamina or something were not put to rest by the vice president's performance.
Let's talk about something that all the candidates appeared to be doing, which was sharing their personal stories. So Elizabeth Warren spoke a couple of times about how she always wanted to be a teacher for most of her life. She dropped out of school at 19. She thought her dream was over until she got a scholarship. Then she got a job as a special needs teacher.
But at the end of that first year, I was visibly pregnant. And back in the day, that meant that the principal said to me, wished me luck, and hired someone else for the job. So there I am. I'm at home. I got a baby. I can't have a job. What am I going to do? Here's resilience. I said, I'll go to law school.
How's the storytelling playing for you, Jamal?
Her storytelling has gotten to be so much better. When I first started hearing Elizabeth Warren a year or two ago, I thought that she was kind of didactic and professorial. And it feels like she's really come into her own, and she's much more running, I think, as a, you know, woman from Oklahoma who went to school in Texas than she is as a Harvard professor. And if I've got my count right, she may be one of the only three or four candidates that's running who did not go to an Ivy League school, which I think is also maybe giving her some part of a touch. Bernie Sanders is the other one who kind of fits that mold. You know, he went to Brooklyn College. And I think that is really, for the two of them, they seem to be in touch with the yearning aspiration of an entire generation of Americans who feel a lot of pain right now. I just had an Uber driver who was talking about being evicted just a few minutes ago. Americans are really feeling pain. And I think it's not just about going back to some normal that that existed before Donald Trump, I think Americans are looking to go back to some new normal where everybody has a shot to succeed
again. Right. Andrew Yang didn't get as much time as some of the other candidates on the stage, but he used some of it to tell his story, too. Have a listen.
My father grew up on a peanut farm in Asia with no floor, and now his son is running for president. That is the immigration story that we have to be able to share with the American people.
Jamal, is it just me? He seems to be so much stronger now in the debate stage than he was in debate number one.
He is stronger. Listen, the Yang Gang, as they call themselves online, they're strong too. I'm on Hill TV, and we get a lot of comments from folks who really like Andrew Yang. And last night, you know, he had an idea about giving $1,000 and money to some of the supporters out there so that they can spend that money on the causes they think are important. You know, I'm not sure if that is legal, but it certainly is a very, it's a compelling and big idea that disrupts the status quo.
And Jamal, just to wrap up here very briefly, as a Democratic strategist, what was the moment on the stage last night that made you smile?
That made me smile. Listen, I think when I went to Morehouse College, which is a historically black college, and when Kamala Harris began talking about being a girl from an HBCU, that made me smile because here we have an HBCU graduate, the very first one I can think of who was a major candidate for president, and we were having a debate at a historically black college. And I think it's helpful to remember when everyone was really celebrating Barack Obama last night, they were doing that in front of a mostly audience full of people of color.
We can feel you smiling right now. Democratic strategist Jamal Simmons, thank you.
Thank you.
One of the suspects behind a major counterfeit vaping ring in Kenosha, Wisconsin, is in court today. Kenosha County Sheriff David Beth said this week that investigators are checking if there's any connection with the recent spate of lung injuries that have confounded health officials.
Across this nation, we've lost six people. Hundreds and hundreds have been hurt. I'm very curious, and we're willing to work with any agency in this country to see if our people here in Kenosha County have any responsibility in hurting the hundreds of people throughout the United States.
We're joined now by Milwaukee Journal Sentinel investigative reporter Raquel Rutledge. Raquel, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And police say this could be one of the largest counterfeit vaping operations in the country. 3,000 to 5,000 cartridges produced every day. What else can you tell us about the scale of the bust?
Yeah, well, they did a raid on two places in Kenosha last Thursday. One was a condominium that was being rented under a fake name, and this is where the operation took place. And it was in a high-end neighborhood in Kenosha, and there they found 30,000 vape cartridges that were filled with a gram of THC each, and another nearly 100,000 vape cartridges that were empty and being ready to be filled.
And do we know anything about where those cartridges were being sold? Was it just locally on the black market, or were they getting shipped out across the country?
Well, they were pretty tight-lipped about that at this point. They suspect they were getting the THC oil from California. They had 57 mason jars filled with this refined THC liquid. You know, they hired 10 people to work this operation where they were taking little syringes and filling these cartridges and then packaging them in labeling that, you know, counterfeit labeling that, you know, can be gotten online very readily. But they wouldn't tell us how they were distributing it yet. That's something that's still under investigation, whether they were using the mail, U.S. postal system, or just strictly on the street. It's unclear at this point.
What else do we know about what chemicals may have been in those cartridges aside from THC?
They also didn't have any more information on that either. Those mason jars have been sent to a lab for testing. So we don't know if they were cutting them with anything else or what they might have been cutting them with.
Of course, the reason this is such a compelling story is that health officials across the country are trying to figure out why hundreds of people have gotten serious lung injuries from vaping. Six people have now died. And one of the main suspects, though we don't know for sure, has been the potential that counterfeit products like this are to blame. What did police say about that? Have they been able to make any kind of connections whatsoever?
Well, that's something they've called in. You know, federal officials are trying to make any kind of connection that they can. So you've got FBI, CDC, FDA, everybody really trying to nail down what specifically is causing these injuries, like you said, across the country in 30-something states. But they don't have not linked that yet. But we do know that, you know, 80-something percent of the people that have been severely injured did report they had vaped with THC. So that does appear to be a likely culprit.
I know some people have been surprised to learn that there is such a robust counterfeit market for these vaping products. Can, do you have any insight into how common this is?
Yeah, well, I mean, that is true. People are surprised, but it's interesting. I mean, 2018 was a big year. This operation in Kenosha, police suspect, had been running since January of 2018. And just in April, a criminal complaint was filed against two other folks in Milwaukee who were running an operation. They were making $2 million per month selling these fake cartridges. So the underground market is very robust in states where cannabis is illegal. And I mean, part of that is because this stuff doesn't smell. I mean, it's very stealthy. And so teenagers and other folks can do it sort of on the sly. In Colorado, where it's legal, I'm told that it's very, very small percentage of the market in those such states.
Okay, we'll see how this story fits into the bigger picture of this lung injury problem, if at all. That's Milwaukee Journal Sentinel investigative reporter Raquel Rutledge. Raquel, thanks for speaking with us.
Oh, thanks for having me. Thanks for your interest in the story.
Could smartphones help us determine when someone will commit a mass shooting? And should it be used to track people with a mental illness? That idea is something that the White House is looking into. It is controversial and part of the president's long-time focus on mental health to prevent mass shootings instead of gun control. William Wan is national correspondent for The Washington Post. He's been covering this proposal. William, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So the idea is called Safe Home. It stands for Stopping Aberrant Fatal Events by Helping Overcome Mental Extremes. Can you explain how it would actually work?
The basic idea is use the iPhones, the smartwatches, Fitbits, Echoes in people's homes of people who are mentally ill to kind of monitor very small changes in their voice, their body, and supposedly use that to detect when they're about to turn violent and, you know, kill and hurt people.
There has been criticism of this idea, this concept. You spoke to Marissa Randazzo. Can you explain who she is and what her main critique is?
Right. So Marissa Randazzo, she was the chief research scientist for the U.S. Secret Service for many years and had, was looking into precisely this idea. You know, they have to prevent not just, you know, assassination attempts, but they protect all sorts of high-level folks in the government. So she was telling me how there's many different flaws in this idea. The biggest one is that mental health is directly connected to mass shootings. That is like a flawed premise to explore any kind of research because, you know, there's been many studies of mass shooters. None of them have found like a high level link between mental illness and their mass shootings. They're disturbed individuals. There's no question about that. But like whether like diagnosable mental illness leads to mass shooters and directly influences that is not a strong link by any means. So that's the first kind of problem. But there's many other problems, including the whole idea of predicting violence is a very difficult one. And many people have tried different ways at it and found it to be kind of a fool's errand.
It also feels like something that might be out of a science fiction novel where your tech is kind of checking you out and checking out your mental well-being.
Yeah, and there's this whole, like, when I was talking to researchers, they kept, you know, everyone's kind of jokingly bringing up Minority Report, that Tom Cruise movie where there's, like, pre-crime, pre-addiction of...
Right? Before you've done the crime, you're already napped, right?
Right, yeah, and that is, like, one fundamental kind of problem, too. There's this idea of, like, false positives in any kind of research. So how do you, in order to catch the, like, needle in the haystack, you would have to round up tens of thousands, maybe even hundreds of thousands of people and like sort through them. Excruciatingly painful work of like takes a lot of manpower. So say you're at a military base, there's like four or five different things in these sensors that would say, oh, maybe this person is at risk of committing violence. So then you would have to vet every single one to find that one person who might, you know, and even then, how do you know if that person really would become a mass shooter without them becoming a mass shooter? It's a difficult, maybe even impossible problem to tackle.
So after the shootings this summer in Texas and Ohio, the president said mental illness and hatred pull the trigger, not the gun. I'm just wondering, is this proposal another way to deflect from Democratic proposals on gun control?
I mean, it's hard to be in the president's head or in the White House, but on the White House's end, it gives them some way of saying, you know, we're coming up with solutions. We're bringing things to the table that are not, you know, gun control, not NRA angering kind of things.
You spoke to Jeffrey Ling. He's one of the scientific advisors on this proposal, and he was quite bullish about the critique of it. Explain that a little bit more.
Yeah, so Jeffrey Ling is the lead scientific advisor. And so what Ling's point is that, you know, the worst you can do is fail. Failing is where we are already. Mass shootings are continuing unabated. You know, what's the harm in trying something new? He also makes the point that, like, you know, you doing out-of-the-box ideas like this can lead to, you know, fortuitous other discoveries. So say you're trying to solve the mass shooting idea, finding people before they become mass shooters. What you may find is like a technology that helps you prevent suicides instead. And is that really failure if you find something else by doing that research?
William, you see a lot of ideas coming out of the White House. Where do you see this idea about safe home tech, being able to judge mental health, maybe able to stop a mass shooting? Do you feel that this is a credible idea?
I have to say, you know, after talking to experts across many fields, technology, mental illness, psychology, violence, risk assessment, it's just riddled with so many problems, flaws in logic that I don't know that it could actually work and whether it might actually cause more harm than good if pursued.
William Wan, national correspondent for The Washington Post, thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
An advisory panel to the Food and Drug Administration is expected to vote today whether it will recommend the approval of Palforzia. It's a kind of medical-grade peanut flour, and proponents of the peanut allergy treatment say it can help by gradually exposing kids to the very food they're allergic to. Right now, just a few hospitals and clinics around the country offer it, but it may be on the verge of taking off nationwide. Alex Smith from member station KCUR reports.
When Porter Hall of Raymore, Missouri, turned one, he was diagnosed with a severe peanut allergy after a bedtime snack landed him in the emergency room. Today, Porter, who's now five, is giving peanuts another shot.
Okay, let's open real big. Let me see in your mouth.
At Children's Mercy Hospital in nearby Overland Park, Kansas, nurse practitioner Jody Shroba gives Porter a quick once-over in preparation for administering a tiny dose of what's essentially peanut dust. Today, he'll be getting a small increase over the tiny amounts he's been taking regularly for the past few months. The treatment is called oral immunotherapy, and Shroba says these sessions can be terrifying for kids and their parents.
Yes, you see the anxiety. They got to kind of psych themselves up for it. They're like, I can do this, I can do this.
Oral immunotherapy is not a cure for allergies. Children's Mercy Dr. Jay Portnoy explains that gradually increasing exposures are meant to reduce severe reactions by exhausting the immune system of chemicals like histamine that lead to those reactions.
We're creating like little mini reactions that are so small that the patient doesn't notice it. Occasionally, they'll get itchy mouth, they might get a little bit of stomach ache, and then as we increase it, they become more and more tolerant of the peanut allergen.
After 6 months, Portnoy says patients may be able to tolerate a few peanuts at a time if they keep the exposures going. And a recent research review shows that oral immunotherapy appears to work, at least inside clinics where patients can pass food allergy challenges. But allergy researcher Dr. Derek Chu of McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario, who was one of the study's reviewers, says things can change after they leave.
Outside the clinic setting, they actually have a much higher rate of reactions. That's 2 to 3 times more likely to react to peanut or the dose that they're exposed to during this desensitization procedure compared to avoiding it or receiving a placebo instead.
Chu says that outside of clinics, factors like exercise, hot weather, and illness can affect allergic reactions, making it more likely for patients to have reactions to peanuts. The vast majority of these reactions are mild, but children doing the therapy had about a 20% chance of having a life-threatening allergic reaction compared to about 7% doing placebo or avoiding peanuts. That's according to the research review, which appeared in the medical journal The Lancet. Chu says that with all of oral immunotherapy's costs, risks, and complications, the jury is still out on who might experience an improved quality of life from it.
What we do need to ask is this really ready for prime time? And I think there's some significant gaps in understanding the values and preferences of patients, and as well as knowing if are we fully there for en masse use. I'm not saying no, I'm not saying yes, but I'm saying we need to have a very, very robust assessment to know for certain where we're at.
Children's Mercy's Dr. Portnoy says he hasn't seen any reactions more serious than an upset stomach during treatments, but he acknowledges that families will need to weigh the risks and benefits for themselves.
Okay, I think we're ready. You ready?
Yeah.
Okay, high five. Nice.
After Porter Hall's checkup, the nurse stirs some peanut flour into apple juice. Now that he's done a few months of oral immunotherapy, the 5-year-old seems to take it in stride. With plenty of epinephrine nearby, he casually sips the solution down and goes back to skimming through a book.
Good job, bud. Get that last little bit.
Need more?
No, he got it. Good job.
Porter recently completed his peanut dose increases, but he'll need to keep taking daily maintenance doses indefinitely. That means he'll continue to be at higher risk for severe reactions. Nevertheless, Porter's mom, Amy, says just seeing him get this far has been reassuring.
It's made me be a little bit more at ease with him being able to eat at other people's houses or, you know, like when Halloween rolls around. You never know what kind of candy they're going to get. It makes me feel a little bit more at ease, but not 100%.
And if oral immunotherapy grows, as proponents of the treatment hope, many other families may be weighing the benefits and risks as well. For Here and Now, I'm Alex Smith.
China has extended an olive branch in the ongoing trade dispute with the White House. China's state news agency said today that Beijing is hitting pause on additional tariffs that were planned for U.S. agricultural products. And yesterday, Chinese companies bought 10 boatloads of U.S. soybeans. It was the largest purchase of its kind in more than a year. Robin Farzad is host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Robin, welcome back. Welcome back.
Hello, sir.
And earlier this week, President Trump announced that he is delaying another scheduled round of tariffs on China. These seem like peace offerings ahead of next month's planned trade talks in Washington. Does that sound right to you?
Peter, they are MSG-rich appetizers intended to get Beijing to the table for a long, expensive, full dinner. How's that for metaphor?
How long had you been thinking about
These come to me naturally. What are you talking about?
Okay, so a peace offering, an MSG appetizer, whatever you want to call it. If tensions have thawed for now, what should expectations for a deal rise at all, really, though?
It depends on the day, of course. I think if you were to study this in a B-school negotiations class, you'd zero in on things that you could do, if you're D.C., to put the screws to the other side without hurting your constituents too much here. I mean, if you look at pork, that's China's national protein. Soybeans, not unlike rice, that's an essential foodstuff. The government needs imports from the U.S. to meet demand. So how much could you put temporary pain on the kind of farm belt here for China to feel that?
This really does feel like a bit of a swerve from earlier in the month when both sides were ratcheting up the tariffs and President Trump was tweeting out that American companies were hereby ordered to find someplace other than China to do business. So, I mean, just tell me more about what you think's behind that strategy.
Yeah, I think on the margin, our farm belt is hurting, and China at the same time is worried about its pork supply. So you have these pressure vent releases amid a broader showdown. And Trump seems to be ending this week in a conciliatory mood. I mean, on the margin, he's even willing to discuss incentives for Iran, his other big target for economic isolation. So that's Trump. Let's see how he feels on Monday. But certainly this is all within the rubric of carrot stick. And I think I'm out of metaphors.
And boy, he's got to feel pretty good, though, because China has made this significant purchase of soybeans now. Good news to U.S. farmers who are important to the president's reelection bid.
No doubt. But our agricultural exports to China were still cut in half last year, and they've fallen another 20% or so to start this year. And farmers are struggling, and they're howling to their representatives in Congress.
All right. More news this week. We saw that the U.S. deficit swelled past the $1 trillion mark. It's the highest level now in 7 years. A lot of economists are blaming President Trump's tax cuts for this as a big reason why. Did this sort of pass quietly? Is anyone concerned?
Well, we're not. No one's really talking about it. The bond vigilantes here, they're not in the streets yet. In fact, they haven't been seen for decades. If anything, you know, read the paper today. You have companies and local and state governments selling extra long-term cheap debt. Mm-hmm. I think this is another form of American exceptionalism. People want our debt. People want our dollar. And we can be profligate and not get punished for it.
All right. That's Robin Farzad. He's host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Robin, thanks as always.
Have a good weekend.
You too.
The Bahamas could be in for more bad weather. A potential tropical cyclone is moving toward them. Nearly 2 weeks after Hurricane Dorian, that was a Category 5 storm, ravaged the islands. Parts of Great Abaco Island and Grand Bahama, the hardest hit by Dorian, are littered with leveled buildings and debris. And at least 50 people have died and 1,300 more are still missing. But officials say that number could change as the death toll is expected to rise. So for more on this potentially severe weather headed to the Bahamas, let's bring in Jeff Huffman. He's a meteorologist with the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. Jeff, good to have you here.
Good afternoon, Femi.
Potential tropical cyclone, where is it right now?
Well, it's pretty much stalled, or it's really not even a system yet that has a well-defined center. So it's kind of this broad area of low pressure in the southeast Bahamas. It is becoming a bit better organized, and I think by tonight or tomorrow it'll officially be classified a tropical depression or even a tropical storm.
All right. So it means it's getting some shape. That's more classic hurricane-looking shape. Who needs to be paying attention to this right now?
Well, the good news is this is nowhere close to the strength of Dorian, but unfortunately it is taking somewhat of a similar path into the northern Bahamas tonight and through tomorrow, and then potentially bringing some coastal hazards to Florida and the Carolinas. Right now, the official forecast track and a lot of the models have moved in a direction that keeps the center of this developing storm well offshore, not only well offshore of Florida, but likely far enough away off the shoreline of the Carolinas to prevent a significant impact.
So are we looking at heavy winds, high tides? What would you say we should be prepared for?
Yeah, well, in the northwestern Bahamas, of course, were the areas that were hit from Dorian. You know, even an afternoon downpour would, of course, not be good news for some of the recovery efforts there. But this is nowhere close to what Dorian produced. Mm. Certainly some heavy rain, gusty winds, and some higher seas. And then in Florida, we have a tropical storm watch on the east coast of Florida. That means tropical storm conditions are possible. Remember, that does not mean that they're likely. We'll see if that's upgraded over the weekend. But I think we're talking maybe 30 to 40 miles our wind gusts along the coast, some high seas, some coastal flooding, beach erosion, and the rain bands may rotate in at times. Certainly not a significant event in Florida.
All right. So for anyone just tuning in, just listening here, how nervous should they be?
Well, obviously there's a lot of anxiety because of Dorian. And then, of course, the last 2 or 3 years, we've had very active and direct hits from major hurricanes. This one is something I don't think will be significant. However, we certainly should keep our guard up for other potential hurricanes. We're only halfway through the hurricane season, and we still have several more weeks to go with possible activity.
All right. Jeff Huffman, meteorologist with the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Now let's head to the Bahamas, where we find Rashad Rowe. He's a reporter for the Tribune, the most circulated daily newspaper in the Bahamas. He joins us from Nassau. Rashad, thank you for joining us. It has been nearly 2 weeks since Dorian devastated the Bahamas. At least 70,000 people are now homeless, and a potential tropical cyclone is on its way. How are you preparing?
Right now, we are sort of just listening out to the news to try and determine what exactly we could expect from this. Bahamians don't typically prepare as much as they should until a tropical storm like this progresses to a hurricane. So you don't have a lot of people right now going to the shops or buttoning up windows and the like. It's just listening out at the moment.
So you're in the capital where relief efforts are staged. And how many people do you know of that are currently staying in shelters? How are the operations running right now?
So right now we have about 2,000 people currently staying in shelters. About 3,000 or 4,000 other displaced residents that have come to the capital that have gone to stay with family and friends for the time being. The shelters are overcrowded. One of the shelters has about 1,500 people. And up to a couple of days ago, the government was still opening new shelters in order to increase the capacity.
Rashad, in the Bahamas, this has been such a huge natural disaster. It must be hard to actually report on it. Have you lost people? Have you had friends who've lost people? Can you talk to us about what that is like?
I haven't lost friends, but I definitely have a very acute sense of what's going on because I was on Abaco when the storm struck. I had been sent there to cover the storm. And I did expect a destructive storm that would be very damaging for low-lying areas, that would be very damaging for buildings that were not built to code. What we didn't expect was an unprecedented storm of this nature that would destroy so many of the areas that have traditionally held up in the hurricanes that Abaco has faced. I, for instance, stayed at the top hotel on Abaco, the Abaco Beach Resort, which is where the insurance executives, the news media crews, top government officials all stayed. And before the first half of the hurricane had even ended, our room was already compromised. And we already transitioned from thinking about the story to thinking about our own well-being. So it's had an impact on me in that sense, for sure. And it continues to have an impact because those images, they stick with you. You know, some people have described it as it's as if the island was lifted up and then dropped down on its head.
The conversations that you're having with survivors 2 weeks later, what are they like?
Very difficult. I spoke to a survivor at a shelter, a 50-year-old man who did maintenance work for electrical companies. And he told me whenever he hears a bam or a loud noise, he gets intimidated. I spoke to a man who told me four of his friends died in the storm. I spoke to a woman who tried to convince me that she lost as many as 30 friends in the storm. And she began listing all of their names. It remains incredibly difficult for them. I think they're dealing with it the best way that they can. Most of them look wary. And when you go to the shelter, there's a certain quietness to it. And you can tell people are still processing everything that's happened.
As somebody who knows the Bahamas really well, this is your home. How is the way that you're reporting very different from the way that you're seeing outside news agencies reporting on the fallout from Dorian?
Right now, I would say we're beginning to transition into a focus on how this is going to impact certain government systems and functions, which I don't think is the focus of a lot of the international media. For instance, this storm has resulted in 10,000 children being displaced. Those children would have begun school on Monday, but now they are just beginning the process of trying to be placed into a new school on a new island. Public schools here in the Bahamas, especially New Providence, they are overcrowded. So we're faced with a situation where lots of people are going to have to be in the same classes of upwards of 40 people, for instance. That's the kind of thing that might not be as relevant to an international media.
Talking about today, the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres is heading to the Bahamas to express his deep solidarity with the people there. He talks often about climate change. I'm just wondering if in the Bahamas, your government is saying that this hurricane that came through, that Dorian, that is most definitely, the power of it is most definitely connected to climate change. Are you talking about it in that way?
Not yet, because it's been such a devastating hurricane. So there are more immediate concerns. But the government has, for much of the last decade, expressed its concerns about climate change. I believe by some estimations, the Bahamas is the country that could be most affected by climate change because it's such a low-lying area. We experience hurricanes almost every other year. And I think those conversations are going to continue and progress as we take care of some of the more immediate needs.
Rashad Rowe, a reporter for the Bahamian newspaper, The Tribune. Rashad, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
The data centers that feed China's appetite for internet and high-speed video streaming are consuming a tremendous amount of electricity. According to a new report from Greenpeace and the North China Electric Power University, the buildings that store all that data produced 99 million metric tons of carbon last year. That's equivalent to 21 million cars. And the hidden cost, by the way, of the internet is not just a problem in China. Ben Brock-Johnson covers tech for Here and Now. Hi, Ben.
Hi.
So we know that cars and airplanes and factories are big polluters, but I'm willing to bet that a lot of people don't think about their carbon consumption on the internet. So, you know, tell us what these data centers are doing, especially in China, that they're so hungry for all this energy.
Right. So there's a couple of things going on here, right? Number one, the movement of everything to the cloud, all kinds of information instead of being stored locally on our devices is being stored somewhere else, always accessible via the internet. That is great for convenience and it helps us in a lot of other ways too, like using large data sets to solve problems, making our cities, our houses smarter, etc. And of course, Netflixing and chilling. So ironically, the phrase moving everything to the cloud is a problem for our actual climate, right? Now, this is a global problem. An estimated 3 to 5% of all electricity used globally now is data centers, Peter. And that number might sound small, but it is comparable to the airline industry. But in China, when you look at where these data centers are and how they access power that runs the data centers, a lot of that power is coal. And this report really pointed that out and called that out.
So this report from China says the problem is getting worse there, that in 5 years, China's data centers will consume as much power as the total amount consumed by Australia in 2018. What does Beijing think about this? I mean, does the government see this as a problem?
Yeah, so I think this is a good question. I'm not a China environmental policy expert, but I will say that government did start a pilot program for green data centers in 2015, right? So that seems to signal at least that the government is thinking about this. Also, Alibaba has launched data centers powered by solar and hydroelectric power in the country. But while we talk about this data center issue as a problem that feels invisible, Beijing's environmental awareness in the last decade has really come from actually a visible impact of its reliance on fossil fuel. Right? The smog of Chinese cities is now legendary and super dangerous, and the government is concerned about that, which is part of what has led to some pretty legendary solar power innovations in China to the point where it has now surpassed the U.S. in a lot of clean tech. So I do think it is possible that a larger evolution of the government's feelings on environmental responsibility might impact this newer tech sector's data use.
And to be fair to the Chinese, we're all very hungry for internet use and internet consumption. So how do data centers in the U.S. compare?
Yeah, so for a long time, the record in the U.S. was also not great, and we are slowly but surely improving on that front. Apple now says all of its data centers are powered by clean energy. Microsoft is saying it will get to 70% by 2023. Amazon is actually way behind at about 50%, but the company has sort of written that it wants to improve this number. Google and Facebook are also on this. They're talking about building data centers in cooler places, Finland, Sweden, moving away from, say, building them in Nevada, which I think gets kind of warm. So we should also say that data centers are getting much more efficient at the same time. So as they get bigger and more consolidated, they can rely on fewer, more powerful servers and focus on larger cooling efforts. So in some ways, we're making strides even as we are creating a bigger problem, which is like humanity's MO, I guess. Yeah. I don't know.
And you make a good point. I just want to be clear. These buildings are doing a lot of work. They create a lot of energy. They put off a lot of energy. They get very hot. They need to be cooled down by air conditioning units. So that's why putting one in Las Vegas, for instance, is going to take a lot more energy.
Yeah.
But why do you think those U.S. companies are making such public steps to do this?
So tech companies, which we should remember from releasing new devices full of precious metals like every 6 months to contributing to our global consumption of terawatts of power, last number I checked was over 400 terawatts of power annually, are far from good actors here when it comes to the problem. But they are sort of culturally appointed to be pro-environment, right? Environmental responsibility fits the brand identities these companies want to project. And as large tech companies become more competitive with each other, as Apple becomes more of a service company and Google becomes a device company, they want to convince users more and more to think of them as somehow different, even if they aren't, right? So corporate responsibility when it comes to climate change is a way to differentiate. But also environmental organizations like Greenpeace have really been pushing these companies on this front. They give different companies scorecards. There's been a lot of advocacy as well from outside of these companies. And, you know, where you see big tech in the U.S. going on this issue, you might see Chinese tech giants follow suit. But there's an activism aspect of this, too, at least in the U.S., right? About 1,000 Amazon workers plan a walkout actually on September 20th to protest the company's failure to address its environmental issues. And you might imagine that going down a different way in China.
Fascinating. And we saw a statistic that said one Google search is the equivalent of powering a 60-watt light bulb for 17 seconds. So think about that next time you're clanking away on your keyboard.
Exactly.
Ben Brock Johnson covers tech for Here and Now. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Femi Okeh. It's Here and Now.